From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and this is a show where each week we deal with mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you willing to keep repressing the emotions and the belief systems that really harm and hurt who you are and how you live in the world? And this is a show where hopefully you'll be able to get some insight and some tools to move up and move forward in your life. Now, before I go any further, I want to acknowledge my sponsor, the Rainbow Mobile Notary Services and Charles King. And we all know that in light of past recent events with the Terry Schiavo case, each day hundreds of individuals face difficult life-altering decisions and are not properly prepared, especially as we've seen even with the situation in the Gulf Coast today. Don't let this happen to you. Let Rainbow Mobile Notary Services help. We all tend to avoid stressful, emotional, physical, and financially charged issues and convince ourselves it's never going to happen to me or have time to deal with this. And as we've seen in the Gulf Coast, people didn't have time to deal with a lot of things, and we're going to be talking about today. Now, for your own peace of mind and for the well-being of those you love, don't wait or procrastinate. Let Rainbow Mobile Notary Services assist you with living wills, trusts, estate planning, medical power of attorneys, and much more. Plan now. Prevent problems later. Rainbow Mobile Notary Services will come to you, to your home, to your office, even to a hospital room, to help notarize and make legal those documents that really have a tremendous impact on you and your life and your loved ones. So to take care of these issues, call Rainbow Mobile Notary Services at 480-518-2090. That's 480-518-2090. Or you can visit their website, which is www.rainbowprof.com. That's rainbowprof as in professional. .com, P-R-O-F, Rainbow Prof. So I want to thank Charles King and Rainbow Mobile Notary Services for their support of the show, and we're going to get right into today's show. And so much is going on today with the trauma of what's going on in the Gulf Coast. And the hurricane named Katrina, but also the aftermath of the hurricane. And today we're going to be talking about how to deal with the trauma of natural as well as human-made catastrophes. Now, to define trauma for a minute, the dictionary says it's an extremely distressing experience that causes severe emotional shock and may have long-lasting psychological effects. Now, I realize that most of what's in the news right now is not about the psychological issues, and rightly so. The things that have to be dealt with first are the search and rescue, reestablishment of material safety and security, feeding people, helping them reconnect with loved ones, and getting some semblance of order back together. Now, unfortunately, that's all taken longer than many of us believe it needed to or should have. But in the meantime, things are beginning to show up. People are getting to other cities where they can be cared for. The issue of trauma and what's going on, I want to address one thing, because here I am part of the media. And I know that the media can provide tremendous service but can also do tremendous harm. And I want to address something before I get into introducing my guests and getting right into the meat of today's topic. I really need to address Bill O'Reilly and his show on Wednesday that I got to watch. With all that was going on and everything else, he spent an hour focusing on looters and criticizing law enforcement for not getting on top of the looters and criticizing the local law enforcement, many of who lost their precinct buildings. There was one community that had 20 police cars and 12 or 13 of them were lost. Their own families and loved ones were caught up in the floods and the hurricane. Many of the police officers themselves may have. They were shorthanded. Looters, most of which were hungry and searching for food, which I can't imagine them begrudging anybody the opportunity to get food in stores where it was only going to be left to rot anyway. And most of the police officers said as long as it was food that they weren't going to do anything. But he focuses on criticizing a overextended local law enforcement that was not getting the state or national support they needed. And his thing for an entire hour was to criticize the fact that they weren't addressing the looters. And to me, that is how the media can actually increase the trauma. It increases the image that everything that's going on in the New Orleans area and the Gulf Coast region is chaos. And while there are people who are contributing to that, there are also the vast, vast majority of people who are helping out the total strangers. And I just want to read a couple of quotes here from the Los Angeles Times today. And one of them is that talking about one guy that survived and he had to stay on top of the car in his garage, but the water continued to rise. So he made a run for it, dragging several neighbors out behind him on an inflatable raft as he swam, then waded through waters. He made it several miles west towards downtown and higher ground, then watched police stop at gunpoint a rider van that had been hot-wired by thieves. The officers told the men inside that they had to stop looting and must try to get people out of the neighborhood, that people were dying. Believe it or not, these dudes got the message, Williams said. The thieves began ferrying people out of the devastated neighborhoods to the east. The police had deputized looters. They had to, Williams said. There was no other way to get people out. The thieves dropped him at the convention center, and he had been there ever since when the troops arrived. Now, that's one issue. Sometimes all people need is some direction. And another thing, in another article, that the Reverend D.C. Cofield, pastor of the Good Hope Missionary Baptist Church, said he was worried that help could not be arranged fast enough for all refugees. Quote, my nightmare scenario is that those people we don't find help for soon enough, he said. Even good people, if put under enough stress, will do bad things. Although some tempers frayed and a few arrests were made, the Astrodome relief effort appeared to be running effectively. But the important thing is, even good people put under enough stress will do bad things. And to imply that the majority of the people, or even too many of the people, I mean, one is too many when it comes to this type of behavior, but these are circumstances that none of us have ever lived through, at least most of us have never lived through, and cannot judge what we would do in those situations. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Trauma, particularly the trauma associated with, to me, the hurricane is a piece of it. But most of what they're dealing with down there is not so much a direct result of the hurricane, but of the dikes giving way and flooding New Orleans. Now, part of this is the natural disaster, which is Hurricane Katrina. Part of this is the human-made disaster, which is the dikes that needed upgrading, and where the city of New Orleans had requested $2 billion from the federal government that got cut from the federal government's budget just this past year because of budget cuts, and so that the city of New Orleans didn't even have the hope of upgrading these dikes. And now, instead of saving the $2 billion from the budget, it's going to be costing us probably $50 billion in order to deal with this, if not more. The other human-made disaster trauma here is the lack of quick response and money. And that, again, we can address and we can talk about and debate all day, but the important thing is response is beginning to happen. People are beginning to get cared for. And so we're going to be talking today with a friend of mine who actually was a guest in March on my show. Her name is Susan Sugar. She's a licensed clinical social worker in the Phoenix area and a certified EMDR therapist. And the show we did last time really talked about eye movement desensitization and reprogramming, which is EMDR, which actually helps people deal with past traumas. So we're going to be talking about trauma. And Susan, I really want to welcome you back to the show again, and I know it's short notice, so thank you for being here. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Stuart. I thank you so much for having me on today. This is such an important issue and an important impact on everybody around the country.
Now, an email I got from the EMDR International Association just yesterday, as a matter of fact, said, If past experience is a guide, at least 15% of survivors will sooner or later present symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
That will require treatment. In addition, and I want to deal both with the initial victims, but in addition, many first responders and later caregivers will likely experience secondary traumatization that can benefit from therapeutic intervention.
Correct.
Talk to me about trauma, first of all. You heard my dictionary definition. What is trauma? And what have you seen in your practice? How does that apply to what we're dealing with in the Gulf Coast here today?
Well, I would say that trauma is really something that happens that is out of the ordinary and that can overwhelm our natural resources to deal with things. And it can result in something long-term, but it doesn't always. As you noticed, it was like 15 to 20% might actually result in like a post-traumatic stress disorder. But that's saying that as much as 60 to 80% won't. So it's also going to be dependent on the type of resources we bring into that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But trauma can be, it can be something big like this hurricane. It can be something small. Like a teacher might say to you in third grade that just kind of overwhelms you and gets stuck inside your system.
So if that's the trauma, we talked about is, yes, there's past trauma. I mean, I can give you a list of the ones that come to mind in my own life.
Mm-hmm.
I think back in when I was 9 or 10 years old, I think I grew up in Queens in New York City. And believe it or not, back then we had, in 1959, 60, and 61, I think 3 years in a row, we were hit with major hurricanes. And it actually flooded the neighborhood. Luckily, my house was at the center of the block, so it was slightly elevated. But most of the houses on both ends of the street were flooded, and the corners were flooded. And when I see something like this, it brings back to me, a 9- or 10-year-old, to us it was like, wow, we have a swimming pool at the corner.
Right.
Nobody... Luckily, that we knew was killed. Houses were, basements were flooded. People lost things, but it was like scary, but an exciting thing to do. So we're in the corner, on the corner, basically playing in the swimming pool, walking across people's lawns in water up to our chest, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which seems innocent enough. And I remember walking across. In those days, we had cesspools, not sewage things for. What we have today in terms of dealing with toilets and water coming from our houses. And I was walking across somebody's lawn, and all of a sudden, this sinkhole appeared and sucked my leg right down into the cesspool.
Mm-hmm.
And if there wasn't a tree right nearby and a branch that I just instinctually grabbed, I would have drowned. I would have gotten sucked right under. And, I mean, it's bad enough to drown or to be killed at all, but in a cesspool, I think just But I was able to pull myself out. When I pulled my leg out, of course, all of this garbage from the cesspool came out with it. And so when I see this, it brings back even a cellular memory of that experience. That's trauma, and that's trauma that still lives in myself. And obviously I could use some EMDR to deal with that.
So it's like the body begins to respond again as if that was happening now.
Right.
Even though your adult mind knows you're not in that cesspool right now.
Right.
And that's what happens, is that the experience, if it isn't processed in a way at the time that's, you know, healthy and supportive and whatever, it can lay latent in that brain or in the body for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Something like this can come along, and it can be a lot more subtle than this, but something like this can come along, and it just like a vibration, it just finds that place in the brain, and it activates that memory, and the brain is remembering it as if it's happening now.
Right. And the cells remember it. I mean, it's so much more subtle than it used to be, but my body is feeling a subtle amount of that terror.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So there are two levels of traumatized individuals from this that I identify. One is the direct ones, which are the immediate victims and those first responders and caregivers that we mentioned already. The second level are the indirect ones, the people who are sitting by their TVs watching this day after day after day, who are in surrounding areas around the Gulf Coast that maybe weren't affected immediately, but their services are being inundated with refugees in this country, refugees. So there's the direct affected people and the indirect affected people. Let's start with the victims and then the first responders, who I also see as victims in this, because they're like those police officers. I mean, it's their home, too, and their families, too, and they're still having to work and serve the community. So to criticize them in any way, to me, is just an abomination.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the victims first. They're being displaced. There's so much they're losing. Talk about that trauma.
Well, one of the things you said when you were in your opening remarks, you were talking about things in the news and some of the things that have happened since the hurricane itself. So I'm thinking that with the people that have experienced this, there's at least several levels of trauma that they could be experiencing. There's the initial trauma of the hurricane itself, that fight-or-flight survival mechanism that got kicked in gear when they had to just get through the hurricane. And that's going to affect a lot of people, and some of them might just get through that okay. It would be like having an abuse event that happened, and some people can get through those okay. Sometimes what's even more traumatic or just as traumatic is how people respond afterwards. And I think that's what we're seeing in the last 4 or 5 days, is the response or the lack of response or the perceived lack of response from the people that we had entrusted our safety with, whether it's the local government, the federal government, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the two words that came up to me that I think are going to be the more difficult things to help people with, because they're going to be something that impacts all areas of their life. I mean, the hurricane's over. We can use talk therapy. We can use EMDR to help reduce the body response. But another key aspect of trauma is the thoughts or the beliefs that we connect to it. And I believe that two things that are going to come out of this is a sense of betrayal and our ability to trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that one's going to be more difficult. For one thing, it's going to hook up with, if individuals have a history of feeling betrayed or having trust issues, but also taking that forward into their lives, whether they go back to their homes or whether they go someplace else, just being able to trust, whether it's our government officials or people around them. And that's the part that breaks my heart, is the response that comes after the event. If someone is having a trauma event and then they go and say tell their parent and their parent doesn't believe them, that can be just as, if not more, traumatic than the event itself.
Mm-hmm. Now you're also dealing with there was another quote in today's LA Times from a sociologist named Wellman, a sociology professor at UC Santa Cruz, said there was yet another way to interpret the situation in New Orleans. He said sociologists had found for years that social structures become replicated after natural disasters. The most vulnerable people in society will be the most vulnerable people during and after a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is whether the government took enough measures to protect the most vulnerable people in society. So a lot of people are seeing that, you know, a lot of the people that are in these shelters are the poor people who didn't have their own transportation, who didn't have the financial means
right.
to get out of town, the ones that were basically in society left behind and feeling like in this disaster they were left behind. So these are people that I think in our culture were already feeling betrayed and had little trust in the support system. And that's even more intensified. So, you know, you're talking about betrayal and trust, and I agree with you on this. But now you have an entire community, which is New Orleans is 67% African American, many of whom were in the projects that were in the lowest lying areas. You know, so
right,
betrayal
right.
and trust
right.
becomes a societal thing and a sociological issue as well as an emotional and psychological issue.
And what happened there is something that so many of us can relate to, whether we may, I may not have a hurricane here in Phoenix, but there are different natural disasters that can happen anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all going to start to ask, you know, am I protected by the people that I've entrusted my safety to?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, hopefully we'll be asking ourselves, what do I need to do to take care of myself and to take care of my community?
Right. Right. Well, that's already happening because even here, I mean, in California, we deal with, you know, I mean, we saw the last couple of years with the forest fires as well as the fear of earthquakes. And, you know, our mayor and a lot of communities here are now saying, you know, are now asking, are we prepared if, God forbid, something happens here that may be different from that kind of flooding?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think other communities are asking the same thing. People choose to live where they choose to live. And I think there's a psychological and an emotional reason for why we live where we live. And, you know, part of the trauma that people experience is the grief over loss.
Absolutely.
And the loss, I listed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 areas that people will be dealing with loss. Now, death is just one of them. And it may be the death of the loved ones, you know, or your own near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
The loss of home.
Right.
As, you know, your physical home and
exactly.
everything in it that helped define you. The loss of community, because the entire community has been wiped out. The loss of a sense of purpose. People who had jobs and stuff have no place to go, no income, no sense of identifying themselves on what they do and how they contribute to the community and society.
Yeah, their entire structure has been washed away.
Yeah. And then the loss of separation from loved ones. There are parents whose kids were evacuated on helicopters, but the parents weren't allowed to go, or there are people who are looking for friends and family who have no idea whether they even got out of the water. Then the loss of health, and even through injury or just health issues. The loss, and this is the point where I was getting to, because the loss of familiarity, history, and environment.
Mm-hmm.
That sense of, this is my community. This is the street I go down every day. These are the buildings that I pass every day. This is the history that goes back a couple of hundred years. And my family may have been a part of it all that time, or it may be a new history for us. The whole loss of familiarity and comfort and safety, I think, is probably the least dealt with issue, but probably a bigger issue than many.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do when you're dealing with that particular loss in terms of familiarity and that sense of history and a connectedness to your roots?
Well, it's certainly going to raise that challenge to begin to look at who am I? Who am I when I don't have all those external trappings to define me?
Mm-hmm.
And you had mentioned EMDR, and actually the R in EMDR is reprocessing.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And in a natural, that's okay. But I say that because it's not about reprogramming so much, but about processing the event.
Mm-hmm.
So as the event happens, we're going to have our thoughts and beliefs. We're going to have the physical, you know, visceral reaction to it. We're going to have maybe pictures and smells and everything else. But another key thing is the belief we have about it and the belief we have about ourselves in that event.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that all of these that you've mentioned, including the history and such, is going to present that challenge of how do I – well, first of all, we have to go through the initial trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And then the challenge is how am I going to define who I am
mm-hmm.
at the core of who I am.
Right. In other words, if I'm no longer defined by what I do for a living, and I'm no longer defined by where I live and the things that I have and how I dress, how do I define myself? Which is basically like, you know, a religious minimalist who gives up everything in order to find inner peace, so to speak. So in certain ways, it's very traumatic. In other ways, sometimes good things come out of something like this in the long run, but it's a little too early to propose that to people.
Yes, it's definitely too early to start thinking that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the initial reactions to a trauma like this is to just help people get through the initial stuff, give them a place to talk and vent,
mm-hmm.
support them when they're angry, support them when they're sad,
mm-hmm.
not try to fix it yet, just be there with them, be there for them.
Mm-hmm. Talk more about that, because to me, in all the work I've done over those years dealing with all these friends with AIDS and the deaths that I've endured, which, you know, is the simplicity of learning how to just be present was the biggest lesson that came out of that for me, that there sometimes you feel you want to fix something and do something, but the only thing to do and the best thing to do is be a presence and let people ventilate.
Yes.
So talk more about that, if you could, in terms of what you suggest to people when they're feeling that kind of helplessness and wanting to help.
Well, there's always that delicate balance between wanting to just be present and let somebody be who they are and what they are and express what they need to express, and at some point gently going towards, well, what are we going to do about it? But at this point with this, what we're going to do about it needs to be put aside other than initial survival type things,
mm-hmm.
getting housing, getting clothing, food, getting families back together, and figuring out, you know, how we're going to get people settled in some place.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of who am I, and even this is a hard one because I mean people want to try and figure out where am I going to live.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like their most basic thing right now, I would imagine.
Right. Well, the shelters, as we keep reading in the paper, you know, it's like some of the people in those shelters may be there for a few months, you know, and like Houston's taken in 100,000 people, most of which are low income that need community services, even if it wasn't because of this refugee situation.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, I read, are already going out of the Astrodome looking for jobs, whether it's McDonald's. It just they have such a sense of pride that they're saying, you know, I can sit here and wait, or I can go out and find a job and learn and feed my kids, even if it's not the job I'm used to.
Yeah.
You know, some people are rising to the occasion, and some are just sitting there in shock. And the important thing is that everybody has their own way of dealing with a trauma.
And as the people that are the observers or the people that might be the helpers, the thing would be to be there with them in that, whatever, wherever they're at.
And not judge it.
And if they're not quite ready to run out and get a job at McDonald's, which even that might be part of the trauma response.
Sure.
To run out,
mm-hmm.
and try and fix it right away. Because
right.
The,
wanting to
the
do something
overwhelming
other than
just emotion of what just happened, which
mm-hmm.
is, like I say, be overwhelming. So it would be our jobs to just try and just be there with them. And sort of stifle our own desire to try and get it all fixed. I think one of the things most well-meaning people do in the face of grief is to say, well, it'll be okay. You
right.
know. It'll be fine. Or you
right.
can just find another home and find another house and find another job and you'll start a new family. I mean, that's,
right.
it may be well-meaning in trying to help somebody feel better, but that's not what people need to hear.
It's just minimizing and minimalizing their grief and what they're going through, and it's almost as if they're, you know, it's like you're being serious and somebody is making light of it, and even though their intentions may be good, but you're feeling like, hey, this is not something that's going to be okay ever again in my life. I may get past this, and I may get back on focus and stuff, but this is going to be a loss that will be with me the rest of my life.
You know? Or that's certainly the way it feels right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe somewhere down the road they will make some real powerful meaning out of all this.
Right.
But right now it feels like they've lost everything, and in many cases they have.
Right.
And validating that for individuals can be helpful. Just like, I hear how horrible this is for you.
Right.
My heart is sad for you as well. I feel,
mm-hmm.
I just can feel how difficult and horrible this is going to be or is for you right now.
You know, and to talk for a minute about the first responders and the caretakers, because, you know, whether it's the National Guard that's in there or the local police department, I mean, I'm reading in the papers that many of the National Guard troops that are coming in just got back from Iraq, so they went from one war zone to another devastation, and they didn't even have time to heal what they went through in Iraq before jumping right into this, and a lot of them are comparing the two as just as difficult. So, you know, how do you address these first responders, these people that are putting their own lives on the line to save others at this point, whether they're actually in uniform or whether they're just people from their own community who have risen to the occasion and are becoming these rescuers? How do you address them?
Are you talking about in terms of supporting them emotionally through
them? Yeah. And helping the listeners understand that they're human beings first, and their National Guard and police officers second, to give them their own humanity and at the same time acknowledging them for what they're doing. You know, how do you address them? How do you give them that support?
I guess I would encourage each individual, if they're feeling some kind of judgment about what may or, you know, we have that big should about what should be done. If I ran the world, it would be a great thing. If we could take a step back and just activate and employ our own empathy and imagine what it might be like if I was there, and I think that's happening a lot around the country, around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what would that be like if I was there? And I can't even imagine it. And just begin to have a little bit of empathy for what it must be like to not just be out helping people out of the water, out of their houses, but also to walk down and perhaps see a dead body on the street, or to see the people that are trapped in their attics and people that won't come out because they're too afraid, and what that might be like, and the powerlessness of the individuals that are trying to help.
Talk about the powerlessness a little bit more, because I think that's the key, because even though they're the ones that may have the equipment or finally get in there and stuff, there's also an initial impact that helps them. Even though they're doing something, there's still the sense of, I think, I'm not doing enough. So what's that powerless about, and how does that impact people who are actually out there doing things?
Well, it's the powerlessness of being the magnitude of the problem. I mean, they could walk down a street and go through each house, and then knowing that there are 10 more streets with, you know, 150 more houses. That sense of wanting to just make sure everybody's okay and only having enough resource to get that area right around you, to just do what you can do and to trust that there are others taking care of other areas. And, I mean, I think we saw that driving desire to try and get everything okay in other disasters, you know, around the country, whether it was 9/11 or other areas as well. And, again, these individuals will have to, when it's all said and done, get some sense of meaning from the whole event and knowing that they did all that they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, with all that, they still will just not be able to help everybody all the time in the way that they'd like to see everybody get helped.
Well, I want to talk about the the post-traumatic stress disorder that happens even in the first responders. But I want to remind my listeners, if you're out there and you have a comment or have a question for either one of us, you can call KXAM, 1310 AM in Phoenix, at 480-949-1310. If you're in the Phoenix area or not, it's still the same number, 480-949-1310. Feel free to call in with your comments or questions about this. Do you find, I don't know what your experience has been with, I know that the EMDR Institute actually has sent people to disasters all over the world and have trained therapists on the ground with this technique called EMDR so that it's the local people that are really offering the assistance. What do you find with the post-traumatic stress issues? Is there a difference between what the direct victims are feeling or the first responders usually show months afterwards?
Well, some of the internal issues might be slightly different. It depends on whether the first responders are coming from outside and helping versus, like you said earlier, if they're part of that community, then they might have some of the very similar issues as the actual victims of the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So in term, but one thing to note is that what people are experiencing now is acute stress. And there is actually a diagnosis that we call acute stress disorder. And it's if you're overwhelmed by a situation, you're going to be feeling this. It only becomes post-traumatic stress disorder, I believe it's after 6 months. If the symptoms are still there 6 months later, then we might call it PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within EMDR, let me first say that EMDR is not usually used in a situation immediately like this. The Red Cross and those relief agencies have their own procedures for dealing with the mental health issues that come up.
Mm-hmm.
And within the EMDR community, there's a group called the Humanitarian Assistance Program, or HAP, that also contributes in whatever way they can towards the first responding, towards the emotional or mental health issues that arise, which may or may not actually include the process of EMDR. Because when you're in the middle of this crisis, EMDR is probably not going to be as effective. And it may not even be necessary because not everybody gets PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, within HAP, definitely a response occurring right now in terms of getting people out to the communities where the shelters are. What HAP will do will either work pro bono with people that are victims, or will train local therapists or supervise local therapists to provide services within the community. And they do this around the world. They send out groups around the world whenever there's a disaster or a crisis.
Okay, and so I know that EMDR has been used for years, but I know a lot of people don't necessarily know or understand it. I could say to them that they could go back to March 5th on my archives on Tell the Truth Faster and actually listen to a complete explanation. But that's what that show was about then, was what is EMDR, how is it used, and, you know, how effective is it. And, you know, I'm also trained in using it, and while it's not the primary focus of my practice, it certainly comes in handy with post-traumatic stress issues very often. So I would recommend that if people want more information on EMDR itself, they could go to tellthetruthfaster.com. And go to either, you could do a search on the archives for EMDR, and it'll get us to Susan Sugar's last show in March, and you can listen to a whole explanation. You could also go to, is it EMDR.org?
EMDR.com is the Institute's website.
Okay, and you can get information there. You can also go to my other website, www.mfrankcc.com, and I have a page on EMDR there that just explains it, and also it has a link to the EMDR Institute. So getting back for a moment to the issue of trauma. Now, we talked about the victims and the first responders, but there's the indirect trauma of And I think anybody who lived in this country or anywhere in the world on 9/11, 2001, knows how traumatizing it was to sit in front of our TV screens in a state of shock watching what was going on. That created trauma, not just for the people in New York City and people who were directly related to that devastation, but also to those of us that spent most of our time watching TV and being inundated with that and the pain and the grief we all felt. And
mm-hmm.
So I'm applying that now to most of us are glued to the radio and TV watching the scenes of the devastation there and the catastrophe there. And it also, they may not realize it, well, to some of us it's just another thing on TV, but for most of us there's that inkling that we're connecting to something that is directly related to the horror in our own lives, our own community. So what would you say to the people who are basically witnessing this on TV and not necessarily directly there?
Well, what I've been noticing in my own circle is those of us that are affected, we're talking about it. And we're just venting with each other. We're allowing ourselves to express, you know, the horror and the sadness, as well as the anger and the frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose we each will have to find our own way in which we can feel like we're contributing in one way or another, whether it's sending money to the organizations that are providing relief or providing help to those that are providing the relief, whatever. But again, we're going to be dealing with a different type of powerlessness, but a powerlessness or a helplessness of feeling like something's happening, there's nothing we can do about it, or very little. So I do want to add a little thing. I just heard in the news this morning that as many as 1,000 or more evacuees may be heading towards Phoenix. And I guess it's waiting the governor's approval, and I don't know what the status of that is. So there may be some opportunities for us as a community to help some people that have been affected by this.
Well, even locally, I mean, even in the Phoenix area, I read in the paper today that the Arizona Diamondbacks will donate all proceeds from tickets purchased for their series against the Milwaukee Brewers later this month to the American Red Cross relief efforts. The Diamondbacks will also conduct a Pass the Hat donation campaign that will start with the players and extend to the fans during their games against the Colorado Rockies on September 16th. So, you know, people can, you know, see that, you know, sports figures, celebrities, everyone is doing what they can in their own arena. And I think you were saying that before, too. You know, bring it down to what's doable in your own world and in your own life, instead of feeling overwhelmed or feeling inadequate or hopeless because you can't fix the whole thing.
Or feeling like we should be doing more, or it should be happening in a way that we think would be the most helpful. That's another thing we have to kind of let go of thinking that we know how it could or should be done. And that knowing that if we were to try and if everybody in the country went down there to Louisiana to try and help, that would actually be a hindrance.
Yes.
So we have to help, like you said, in the way that we can, which might be giving the money to those that are providing the benefits.
Which is even why a lot of the organization is saying, don't give us clothes, because we can't process the clothes fast enough. Give us money and we can go to the wholesalers and stuff like that and get new items for people that, you know, I mean, I had a friend call me yesterday because her daughter has a clothing manufacturing company that she got on the phone to all of her retailers and within a day had $250,000 worth of contributions of brand new clothing from all the major stores that she sells to, as well as the manufacturers themselves. And, you know, even though they say don't bring us clothes, they're still looking to bring these clothes together to get them to the agencies locally that at some point these people are going to have to put their lives back together. They're going to need wardrobes. So money is one thing, but at a certain point, they will need items like this. But right now, those agencies are overwhelmed, and money is the best way to go from what I understand.
Right.
You know, I think Jerry Lewis is even donating. He has his muscular dystrophy telethon this weekend, and he went on the air and said, we're going to donate 8 hours of our time, you know, at the beginning and at the end of the show, and you know, he's saying, if you were going to donate $20 to muscular dystrophy, give us 10. Send the other 10 there. I mean, people are putting this in perspective in terms of what's needed in the short run as opposed to what's going on in the long run.
And it certainly has the opportunity to galvanize the nation rather than split it up.
Right. And God knows it's been pretty split for a while now.
Right.
You know, and it's sad that it takes something like 9/11 or something like this to actually get us cooperating and working together. But if we learn from past things, maybe we don't have to do the split again after this is behind us.
Well, you know, sort of as you say that, I'm thinking there's one other aspect of all this that might be worth mentioning, and it may be relevant to some people and not others, would be the spiritual aspect.
Definitely.
Because I believe that the spiritual aspect of how we look at our lives and the events that happen will help people to recover from a trauma like this. And then I think they can recover a little bit more quickly if they have some kind of philosophical or spiritual perception of what's happening.
Well, I talk more about that. What do you mean by a philosophical or spiritual?
Well, because the question that comes up with anything like this is, why did it happen? And why did it happen to me? Or why did it happen to my loved ones? And that's a real difficult one to answer. And as a therapist, I'm not going to tell somebody the answer to that based on what I believe, but try to help them to identify, well, their own beliefs,
mm-hmm.
or to do some research or some reading and see what resonates for them as to what meaning they can put onto this
right.
whole event.
As opposed to the people who say this is God's punishment, and there are people in some countries that are saying, you know, ha-ha, U.S., this is God's punishment for the way you've been treating us, without wanting
yeah.
to get into too political stuff. But there are also, you know, people saying, you know, this is God's punishment for the type of life that the French Quarter in New Orleans lived and stuff like that. I mean, it's, like, so insane to even imply that that's the way a spirit or God works.
Well, I suppose each individual has a right to their own belief system about that.
Yeah, I do agree with that.
They don't have the right to impose that on others, but they have
mm-hmm.
the right to that belief system.
Right.
So the individual that might come into my office, or if I went down to an evacuation site and worked with people, I'd be working with what their beliefs were
mm-hmm.
that would help them get some meaning to the whole thing.
Right.
And it's unfortunate that some of those beliefs are so mean-spirited.
Right. Well, they were interviewing a minister from New Orleans who was in one of the shelters the other day, and she kept saying, well, you know, God saved me from this flood, and then God did this, and thank God I would, you know, it's like, but the implication of saying that God
yeah.
saved me from this is, well, for other people, you know, what
people.
Did I do wrong that God didn't save me from it or my loved ones from it? I think it's important that we watch our words, and it's great to be rejoicing in the saving of our own life or our loved ones and stuff, but I think it can be hurtful to others listening when the implication is, well, I didn't, you know, my loved ones didn't get saved. What's the purpose or... what's the application to that?
It's a difficult question to answer.
Yeah, I know. So I know there's not one we can answer with that, but I'm just saying it because I think people need to be careful of the words they're using and need to be careful of the implications they're putting to their perception of why something happened or what happened to them as opposed to what happened to somebody else. I think people just need to be sensitive to the words that they're using and to the things they're expressing.
And again, there's another level of trauma that can be occurring
mm-hmm.
if people are walking away feeling like in some way God's punishing them
right.
for having, you know, for having this happen to them.
Right, especially when it's coming out of the mouth of a minister. So,
yes.
So, you know, I mean, everybody's in shock and you know, many of us have our own spiritual beliefs and our own religious affiliations or not. And like you said, we all need to honor one another in that and not impose that. So we have about another 7 minutes to today's show. And is there anything else you want to make sure that we cover today or any points that maybe I missed that you want to make sure people get?
Well, one point that just comes to mind as you ask that question is that I'd like people to know that it is possible to recover from trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get yourself surrounded by supportive people and perhaps get help from objective people like a therapist, whether it's using something like the EMDR therapy or other kinds of therapies, we have within us a natural healing innate process to help us deal with these things that come into our lives.
Say that again, because I think that's one of the most important things that's been said on the show today that people need to be reminded of.
We have within us the healing power. It's like hardwired into our systems, a healing power to recover from things that happen to us. And as part of my therapy with people, it's to try and tap into that part of them that knows how they need to heal. And so we might try and sort of work away at some of the things that block that process. And that's what trauma can do. It just blocks that process because it overwhelms the system.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to use whatever skills or whatever tools you have, whether it's just talking and venting to people, getting comfort and help from people to help reduce the impact of that, that the innate wisdom inside of you and that innate healing process can come forward and help you work through the thing that's happening.
Good.
And that's where that getting meaning from it is the part at the end. It's like, okay, you know, we all have stuff happen. And you know, we can learn from it and take that learning into the next part of our life, but we don't have to take all the other aspects of that trauma with us.
Mm-hmm.
If we just put forth the, you know, go through the process in a healthy
right.
way.
I think that is such an important point. Like I said, it's probably the most important thing that's been said on the show this whole hour, is to remind people that there is an innate wisdom and an innate healing power within all of us. And, you know, we've survived things and don't understand how we've survived things. And I think it's because of that life urge, that innate thing that keeps us moving forward even when we're hurting. And I think it's important that people remember it is a part of us. And the whole point of therapy or any kind of work that we do on ourselves is to remind ourselves that that exists and that that's part of who we are.
And to allow it to work, to just activate it and bring it forth.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So I actually want to close here by acknowledging the fact that, like many people all over the world, if not especially all over this country, that while we may not be directly in the Gulf Coast area, that many of us have friends and loved ones that are there and that we have not been able to get in touch with yet. I personally am praying real hard. I have a couple of friends down there, Kira Mosley, her husband, Derek, and their five-year-old son, Evan. And their home was in the flooded area in the Garden District, and I have yet to hear from them. And I know that all I could do was send an email to them, and if she has her laptop with her, sooner or later when she has electricity, she'll be able to check email, and hopefully we'll get word to all of us that they're okay. And it kind of brings it a little closer to home, knowing that, you know, there's someone I was speaking to just 3 weeks ago while she was in her car waiting to pick up her little boy from mm-hmm. school, and just hearing just the sounds of moms going to pick up the kids and the family and all that stuff that just sounded so much a part of the vibrancy of her life down there. And hopefully they're okay and that they'll be able to put things back together and that they'll be able to get in touch with all of us that care about them very soon, even if that community is gone. So my prayers go out to all those people down there, and we all pray for their well-being, and particularly I keep in my heart Kira, Derek, and Evan.
Mm-hmm.
So, Susan, I really want to thank you for taking time. Like I said, I know we just arranged this yesterday and that you're able to do this on short notice. I really felt like you were the one for today's show.
I appreciate you asking me to do this.
Yeah. And how can people get in touch with you in the Phoenix area if they're looking for a good therapist and looking to explore the EMDR a little bit more?
Say, how can they?
Yep.
Oh, well, my phone number is 602-995-3637. And
say it again.
602-995-3637.
Okay, and if you didn't get a chance to write that down, you can always get in touch with us through my website, tellthetruthfaster.com. You can email me, and I'll make sure it's passed right along to Susan Sugar. And what part of Phoenix is your office located?
I'm around 24th Street in Lincoln, right between
okay.
Phoenix and Scottsdale.
Great. So, again, I want to thank you. I want to remind people that even if they're feeling helpless and to do anything about what's going on in the Gulf Coast, part of your own healing process can be doing something in your own community, doing some volunteer work, going down to a homeless shelter or to a food bank or something, where we can't forget that there are still people in our own communities that are in their own sense of trauma and devastation and homelessness and things like that. So keep it within your community also while putting out the money and the energy and the love for the people in the Gulf Coast. So in the meantime, you could be doing stuff right there at home. I want to thank all of you for listening. This is Stu.
Stuart Altshuler on Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix. I'll be here next week, and I want to thank you all for listening, and God bless all of you.
That I heard of once in a life. Some